The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
On December 20th, 2002, 17-year-old Brian Carrick was last seen at the Johnsburg, Illinois supermarket where he worked as a stock boy. The following day, he was reported missing, and then the police found blood spatter near a produce cooler at the store, followed by a bloody fingerprint on the door handle. DNA testing revealed two profiles, Brian Carrick and another stock boy named Rob Render, who had already quit his job and skipped town, while Brian or his body were never found. However, according to the police, Brian's disappearance was much more complicated than it appeared. They believed that another stock boy named Mario Cacciaro, whose family owned the supermarket, had orchestrated an incident that led to Brian's death, while Rob Render and another stock boy were just following orders. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I am so excited today because this story is a story I've been wanting to tell ever since I met the man who lived it, Mario Cacciaro. And Mario's case is unique in so many ways. He's the only person in the history of the great state of Illinois to be convicted of murder without a body being found, with the exception of two guys you've probably heard of and probably wish you hadn't, John Wayne Gacy and Jeffrey Dahmer. And to make matters even worse and stranger and more mind-boggling, Mario was convicted of a crime you've probably never heard of. I'd never heard of it. It's called murder by intimidation. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming my great friend and personal hero, Mario Cacciaro. Mario, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you so much for having me on this wonderful show.
So this story, I mean, you were 19 years old when this happened, but I want to go back even farther than that. And it's crazy, too, because this is a family story, because the alleged crime took place at the supermarket you worked at that was owned by your family. But let's rewind. What was the previous 18 years of your life like before we get up to the fateful occurrence that is the center of this story?
I would say to summarize it short would be a blessing. My parents are the American dream. My mother and father immigrated from Italy, southern Italy. My dad found a job as a janitor at a union company, worked there for 36 years, and retired as union steward and the highest in command of a company that had 12,000 employees. And then he was too young to retire, but too old to start over. So he invested with some other family members to start a grocery store in the far northwest suburbs of Chicago. So we moved out to this small little town called Johnsburg, Illinois. And my parents started a supermarket because it was always my dad's dream to own a business.
Johnsburg, Illinois has a population of less than 6,400 people, so most of the people whose names pop up in this story were all acquainted with each other from either high school, just around town, or from working at Val's, the Cacharo's grocery store, including a few of the stock boys, Alan Lippert, Shane Lamb, Robert Render, and then the victim in this case, a close friend of Mario's, Brian Carrick.
Brian was one of 14 children, nine of which worked for my family's grocery store at one time or another. So it was a family tradition for the Carrick children to work at Val's while they were in high school until they went off to college or the army or whatever endeavors they had in their life. So we were pretty close because they lived also directly across the street from the store on the only main road in town.
Sounds like Smallville, USA, pretty much. Everybody knows everybody. I have like Mr. Rogers visions in my head. But okay, this is the, actually it turns into the opposite of that. So on December 21st, 2002, Brian Carrick, who was 17 at the time, another stock boy at Val's Foods, right there in Johnsburg, Illinois, was reported missing by his mother. And the police determined that one of the last times he had been seen was the previous day, December 20th, when he went to the store to pick up his paycheck. And then 2 days after that, the 22nd, the cops found blood spatter near a cooler that was used to store produce and a bloody fingerprint on the cooler's exterior door handle. Now, DNA tests identified the blood spatter in the cooler as belonging to Brian Carrick. The fingerprint and the blood the print was in that was on the cooler door handle were identified by DNA testing as belonging to Robert Render, who was another stock boy at Val's, as we've discussed. And witnesses told police that Render was present at the store on December 20th. He quit his job, interestingly, on December 22nd and dropped out of sight. You don't need to be Columbo to start to wonder what was going on there, but okay. Now, other stock boys who were present on the day that Carrick was last seen included you. The crime went unsolved for several years, and this poor kid Carrick, his body was never found. Do we know or do we have a strong theory about what actually happened to Brian, and how did Render convince them not to pursue him?
It's a great question that's largely gone unanswered. The lion's share of the physical evidence indicated his involvement in this case, from fingerprints to DNA evidence. The victim's blood is on the top of his shoes that he was wearing the night of the crime. Everything that's undisputed links him to the case. Looking backward years later after civil depositions with the police department, and their defense always was that he wasn't a very big guy. And of course, our defense was that if you're stabbing somebody, you don't have to be a big guy. And Brian Carrick and Rob Render were approximately the same size. I would say Rob was just a little bigger than Brian. But for some reason, because I was a taller person, their opinion was that I was more capable of committing this crime.
You're not a big guy. You're a slender guy. Were you a skinny guy back then too?
Yeah, I was about 145 pounds, 150 maybe tops, 6'1". So I was a skinny, tall guy.
6 years after Brian Carrick disappeared, Rob Render was finally charged, but only with concealing a homicide and not homicide. However, during the interim years, the case went cold and life moved on.
Yeah, I graduated college, and then me and my dad and my brother opened a supermarket on our own because the previous supermarket in Johnsburg had more family members in it and families were growing. So we decided to open our own supermarket, and it was wildly successful.
While Mario's life was going great, an old high school acquaintance, Alan Lippert, was not doing as well.
Now, at this time, I hadn't seen Alan Lippert since probably junior or senior year of high school. So 4 or 5 years had gone by. I went off to college. He dropped out of high school and got really heavy into drugs. He had just been released from prison and then gotten himself in some trouble. He had drugs on him and he was looking at going back to prison for, I think, somewhere between 2 and 4 years. And that is the beginning of what we call the dream confession in our case, because Alan Lippert claimed that he was sitting at his house one day at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning. And then my car pulled into his driveway and I told him that I needed to confess that I was involved in the murder of Brian Carrick.
According to Lippert, in the fall of 2006, Mario confessed that he had told one of the larger stock boys named Shane Lamb to intimidate Brian for reasons related to drug trafficking and, quote, things got out of hand, end quote. Additionally, Lippert said that Brian's body had been buried locally, but then Mario allegedly called his cousins from Chicago to exhume, dismember, and relocate the body to a river in Iowa.
The local police department had Alan Lippert come into my grocery store wearing a wire, and I hadn't seen him in years. And he started asking me how I've been, how's my family, stuff like that. And then he's like, do you remember that night that you stopped over at my house? And I was like, what are you talking about? I haven't seen you in a while. And it was really awkward conversation.
At this point, Mario was still completely unaware that he was a suspect in this cold case until a grand jury was convened.
I was told that they had a lead in the case and they needed help establishing timelines. And then I was brought into the grand jury and I walked in without an attorney because I didn't think I needed one. I didn't do anything wrong. And of course, there's three prosecutors cross-examining you for over an hour. Every question is, how did you kill Brian Carrick? Where did you put the murder weapon? Where did you put his body? Why did you kill him? And I'm just answering, no, no, no. I'm not involved in any of this. So I keep saying no.
Mario still had no idea that Lippert was the source. So after the grand jury, Lippert wired up a few more times. And according to McHenry County prosecutors Michael Combs and Patrick Keneally, Mario's grand jury testimony differed from the recordings with Alan Lippert, and they charged him with 9 counts of perjury. But something about the investigation piqued the interest of the FBI, who interviewed Lippert about that fall night in 2006.
The FBI gave him a polygraph test, and he failed miserably. And then when they asked him why he failed, he said it very well may have been a dream, and that he was drinking alcohol all day, in excess of a case of beer and multiple shots, and that he was also high on mushrooms. And he wasn't sure if I really came to his house or not.
That was their witness, which might explain why the prosecutors were forced to drop 7 of the 9 counts before trial in August of 2009.
We were so confident in that they didn't have any evidence, we actually paid an expert audio person to make the tapes more so you could hear them better. Once you removed all the background noise, you just hear me asking him what the hell he's talking about and why are you asking me that? What are you talking about? And then he tries to change the subject and then ultimately left the store after his attempt to frame me for a crime. And then after we played it for the state's attorney, that's when they dismissed the counts. But then they went to the media and said it was inaudible. But yeah, so then we proceed to the 2 counts that were remaining and we did a bench trial in front of Sharon Prather in McHenry County. And up until this point, a bench trial is not a lot of people usually elect those on a serious criminal defense case. But ultimately, we felt that they had absolutely no evidence because they did not have any corroboration. They had the testimony of a 3-time felon that was looking to get out of an unrelated case that's saying that he isn't sure if it was a dream or not, and that he was on mushrooms and drank a case of beer. That's the only evidence they had. So she dismissed it. She did a directed verdict acquittal.
Wow. Now, I have to ask, did you think that after that not guilty verdict that this was finally over and you could put it behind you?
I did and I didn't. I didn't because of the reaction of the prosecutor. He slammed his hands on his table. And then when we were walking out, he said, this isn't over.
Wow.
And then 3 months go by. And I am pulling out of the parking lot of the store and I get boxed in by white expeditions. They are screaming, get out of the car, get on the ground, get on the ground. I'm laying on my stomach, handcuffed behind my back and shotguns drawn to my head. And one of the police officers tells me, you have been charged with murder.
Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison. Now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and leave us a message. Tell us how these powerful, often tragic stories make you feel. Outraged, inspired, motivated? We want to know. We may even include your story in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
L-A-S-I-K. LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
So it all stemmed from Shane Lamb. He had just been released from prison on an unrelated drug case. They set him up on an operation called Operation Lamb Chop, believe it or not. They got an undercover to ask him if he could find some cocaine. And when he was broke and just got out of prison, he agreed to selling cocaine. And then the undercover had him meet them in a high school parking lot. So now you have a person that's on parole for two class X felonies, and he was looking at like 14 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections. So now they put an insurmountable amount of pressure on him, and they said, well, here is the testimony of Alan Lippert. And Lamb and the prosecutor met, and they had concocted a story.
Shane Lamb was granted full immunity for his cooperation, and in February 2010, they arrested Mario on 6 felony murder counts, as well as concealing a homicide.
I think they just threw anything they could at the wall and saw what stuck. This isn't a office that's known for being very ethical. So Brian T. Landers, who represented me, he previously was a state's attorney in Cook County and then went to become a judge in DuPage County and then came off the bench and took my case.
Lander quickly poked holes in Lamb's story, who alleged that he and Carrick sold weed for Mario and that he was Mario's alleged muscle. Standing at 6 foot and 240 pounds, Lamb alleged that Mario called him into the store to intimidate Carrick and collect from him on the day he disappeared.
Lamb's biggest quote was that if Mario didn't call me, then I wouldn't have been there. So what we did is we got Lamb's phone record and my phone records. And of course, there's no phone calls between me and Lamb at all. In fact, there's no phone calls from me to anybody during the time that they think this murder happened. And that gave him a stump.
The prosecutors dropped 5 of the 7 charges, but they moved forward with 2 felony murder counts, by unlawful restraint and by intimidation. And the indictment read that Mario, quote, or one for whom he was legally accountable while committing the forcible felony of intimidation, struck Carrick in the head, causing his death, end quote. So they brought this case that was predicated on statements that had been impeached before trial. Now, since the defense didn't feel like the burden of proof was met, the strategy was to focus on cross-examination. They pointed out that Lamb was lying about any phone calls that brought him to the store, but nonetheless, he maintained that he was there in the cooler under Mario's direction and punched Carrick in the face. Lamb said, quote, I thought I knocked him out. I knock out a lot of people. Mario grabbed me and said, get out of here, end quote.
My attorney got Shane Lamb on cross-examination to say that he'll say whatever he's got to say to not go to prison. And he said, even lying about a murder case. And then he said, yes. And then we were like, no further questions.
The state trotted out Alan Lippert again to talk about his alcohol and mushroom-fueled fever dream. This time, he added, though, that Mario had told him that, quote, Shane hit Carrick, but it was an accident, end quote. Again, using the info from the FBI interview, Mario's attorney shredded him on cross-examination. Now, had they put on a defense beyond cross-examination, calling Rob Render may have been a winning strategy.
The state put him on the witness list and we prepared for the cross-examination, and then they just didn't call him.
However, the state did present a crime lab technician to talk about the blood evidence that implicated Rob Render.
When we had the state crime lab expert on the stand, my lawyer started asking him, okay, you guys took how many swabs? And he said, we took, I think it was like 36. And then he said, well, are you sure it's not 18? Because I only have 18 that were tested. And he said, no, we took 36, but we didn't have all of them tested.
This meant that there was new evidence available that would further solidify Render's guilt. But remember, Mario's charges were not about violence, but about who orchestrated the incident that resulted in violence. And after 2 days of deliberation, 11 of the 12 jurors believed the state's narrative about drug dealing and muscle men, and that Mario was, in fact, guilty of murder by intimidation.
We thought that there was maybe one holdout that wanted to convict, and it was 11-1 the other way. I mean, they didn't have anything that put me in it. They didn't have a motive, an opportunity, any physical evidence. It was not a situation where I was thinking I'm going to be convicted. So what do I know, though?
We know a lot more now. I mean, by the way, whoever that one person is, I hope they're listening right now, because
lifesaver.
And for everyone who's listening, when you serve on a jury, be that one. You know what I mean? Stand up. It's inconvenient. It can be scary, intimidating. It could take more of your time. You're not going to get home as quickly to your family and the things that you love. But you know what? That person, at least temporarily, saved Mario's life. So here we go to the third trial.
Different jury, but we had actually more evidence that was helpful to me.
This time, Mario's team was going to mount a robust defense beyond cross-examination. First, the remaining blood evidence.
The very first motion that we filed was to have all of the blood evidence examined by the state crime lab. So those came back, and more of them were Render than Carrick. So it's not like he had a little bit of blood at the crime scene. He's got blood all over the place at the crime scene. And the experts that looked at the photographs of the crime scene, they think it was a stabbing. And they think that Render cut himself with the knife, which is why there's multiple places where his blood is actually meshed with Carrick's. So the sample had both of their blood on one sample. And then ultimately, though, Render's thumbprint is in Carrick's blood on the wall. And the print had to have been when the blood was wet. So it puts him at the actual scene of the crime. So about a week after the local news media, Northwest Herald released an article that said that he had blood all over the place. So unfortunately, in between the second and third trial, Rob Render overdosed on drugs on I think it's called a hot shot. So it's like when you take heroin and cocaine mixed together. But he was at a rehab center, which was interesting. So he died at a rehab center.
As strange and shady as that sounds, Rob Render clearly was not going to be able to testify. But the blood evidence could tell that story. Meanwhile, Mario was out on bond when something truly extraordinary happened.
I was at a bar and Shane Lamb had been released from prison and he walked up to me at the bar and his conversation to me is, I'm really sorry that this is happening. I didn't mean for this to happen. I didn't think that any jury would ever actually believe me. I was just saying what I needed to say to get out of prison. The state's attorney told me specifically exactly what I should say. And fortunate for me, there's multiple witnesses around, and one being a criminal defense attorney that is not on my case. And somebody that was near me went and grabbed him and is like, you need to be over here because you're an officer of the court. You should hear this. And this wasn't a situation where Lamb was intoxicated. He had just gotten there and I had just gotten there. It was daylight. And he's sitting there venting, telling me and this whole group of people that he was forced to say all this stuff and that he didn't think the jury would believe it. And that all got entered into evidence in my third trial.
Wow. It's quite a turn of events. He happened to be in that bar, and there happened to be an officer of the court there.
Video camera. Oh, we had it on video camera.
In the bar. Wow. And it wasn't so noisy in the bar that the video camera was able to pick it up?
The audio on that one was garbled because the bar, obviously a loud place. But then you see four or five people standing around just listening. And then you see Ed Donahue on the camera sitting there listening to the conversation. And Ed's an attorney. He was a former state's attorney, and he was a criminal defense attorney in McHenry County. So he's ultimately pulled into this case because he just was a patron of the local bar.
Even with this bombshell impeachment evidence once again destroying the testimony of Shane Lamb, Mario was tried for a third time in March 2013. But this time, the unlawful restraint charge was dropped, which meant that the only charge he was now facing was felony murder by intimidation.
Of course, we alerted the judge that nobody in the country, nobody in common law has ever been charged with this. So nobody in England, New Zealand, Australia, any country that practices common law has ever used intimidation as a predicate felony for murder. And the judge's response was that would be an item for the appellate court to decide. So she wouldn't make a ruling on it and force us to proceed on that last count.
And before trial, the prosecutors did what they usually do when their case is this thin.
The morning that we selected the third jury, the state's attorney's office came to my attorney and said, if you can get your client to plead guilty to concealment of a homicide, which is a class 2 felony, I believe, we'll dismiss the final murder count. And I think at that time, I'd already served 2 years in the county jail. So I pretty much would have dressed in and dressed out because I had no criminal background. But I was unwilling to take a plea deal where I admitted to concealing somebody's body when I had nothing to do with the case.
So the state persisted, once again presenting the evidence that had convinced 11 out of 12 jurors during the second trial.
I actually felt really confident going in because in the third trial, we actually presented a defense in which we brought an attorney, Ed Donahue, to testify on the stand that the state's main and only witness was being told what to say by the prosecution and that he admitted to lying and that none of that what he had testified to was true. But also Lamb, in the second trial, he said that I told him to do it. But then in the third trial, he came back and said that he did it on his own and that I just happened to be there.
With the defense that was mounted, the blood evidence, bone records, Shane Lamb's recantation, and both states' witnesses being destroyed on cross, it's really confusing how we're here speaking with Mario today.
I had the feeling during the third trial that the jury pool was not paying attention. We had an older jury. Every time that we looked over at them, it was like they were like sleeping, but not like resting their head on their arms.
It appears that the state was able to muddy up what should have been very clear waters for a very sleepy jury. And Mario, after fighting the state for now over 6 years, became the first person in U.S. history and common law history to be convicted of felony murder by intimidation.
When the judge read the verdict, people stood up and started screaming at the jury, asking them if they listened to any of the witnesses. I put my head down because I just couldn't believe it. Everybody was up in arms. My parents were crying. And then the two prosecutors were high-fiving each other. And then the one prosecutor ultimately looked at me and said, I told you I was going to get you. Told you it wasn't over.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect.
Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
The very next morning after I was convicted, Brian Thielander came to see me, and he was obviously very apologetic, but also was just telling me he could not believe still that the jury convicted on that evidence. He was pretty broken. I think he actually told me that he lost faith in the justice system from that verdict. And he said that I have talked to the state's attorney. They're willing to cut a deal with you if you can tell them where the body is. So I told him I had no idea where the body was. So even after I was convicted, I still turned down the plea deal. Of course, if I was actually responsible for this crime, I would have taken both opportunities.
In covering Mario's case, we had the opportunity to speak with his post-conviction attorney, Kathleen Zellner, and she told us how she got involved.
His sister worked for a law firm downtown, and she was researching, I guess, wrongful conviction attorneys, and she found me, and then I met with them. I love his family, and you hear his background, and, you know, he already had a college degree, and then the judge has such a horrible reputation. I was all in.
2 days after I was convicted, I get called for a visit. I'm at the McHenry County Jail, and I walk into the visiting room and I see a woman there. I'd never seen her before. So I said, I think I'm in the wrong room. And she said, Mario, I'm here to talk to you. My name is Kathleen Zellner. I'm very interested in helping you. This evidence is so ridiculous that I think that we might be able to get the judge to vacate the conviction before even the sentencing. And then you'll have either a fourth trial or this will be the end of it. We didn't think that was like a high probability, but it was a possibility.
Unfortunately, that possibility did not come to pass, and Mario was sentenced to 26 years.
So I'm down in Menard. Menard is a maximum security prison that is about an hour south of St. Louis. And I was living prior to all this about an hour north of Chicago. So it's about a 6-hour drive for my family to come and see me. It's a max security place, so there's not a lot of movement. I was in my jail cell 23 hours a day. In one sense, it's terrible that you're confined to a small space for 23 hours a day. But in another way, at least you're not open to getting attacked by a bunch of people that have been legitimately convicted of murder offenses. I would say it's probably the worst place I've ever been. Wish it upon nobody. But what they did have that I thought was good was a law library. So I just stayed to myself from the moment I got there till the moment I left. I focused on my case and tried to figure out how to get out of there and did as much legal research as I possibly could and read as many books about the law as I could. I thought that it would be prudent for me to use every moment that I had to focus on freedom, even though I have a great lawyer.
I didn't want to just sit there with the direct appeal. I wanted to reinvestigate because in Illinois, you can file the post-conviction and the direct appeal at the same time. During that investigation, we found a former employee that had worked there that had discovered a pair of men's underwear in the women's restroom up in the ceiling. The tiles had been removed and somebody had thrown it up there and it was bloodstained. And it turned out Rendner had gone in that bathroom He was cut and bleeding. It was his underwear. He used that as a tourniquet to stop the bleeding. And then he threw it up in the ceiling. And it turned out this employee that had discovered a pair of men's underwear, this kid's father was a deputy sheriff. So the father said, we got to take this over to the sheriff's office and turn it in. So they did. And then the police chief threw it away.
Jesus Christ.
He admitted that in his civil deposition, I filed a post-conviction petition along with the appeal so that I could put all the new evidence in that and publicize it.
ABC's 2020 began looking into the case, and Shane Lamb agreed to participate, where he gave a videotaped recantation while exposing state's attorney Michael Combs, saying, quote, all of it was false. The state's attorney set it up. I didn't have anything to do with this. Mario didn't have anything to do with this. I would be indicted for murder if I didn't cooperate. I was following what Combs wanted me to say. They just wanted to close the case. End quote. Wow.
Yeah. And we planned all that with 2020 because that's one of my really good friends, Lisa Soloway. So we had given him like questions. We thought he would give a confession, but if he'd do it on the air, that would be even better.
I can't thank ABC 2020 enough. That show changed everything, I thought, because it really just undermined that conviction. And it just ferreted out how bad the prosecutors are in McHenry County. I mean, it's pretty bad when you have a national show saying that the prosecutors are coercing witnesses and telling them what to say.
That's how you get leverage with the appellate court.
At the time this aired, Mario's direct appeal was pending. In a filing where the focus was insufficient evidence, having the information that your jury appeared to have missed be broadcast nationally probably didn't hurt when a three-judge panel made their ruling.
September 23rd, 2015, I got a call from Kathleen's office. My parents were in the room, and I think ABC taped it. Kathleen said the appellate opinion came out and they overturned your case and you are going to be a free man. All three judges said that no reasonable juror could convict me based on the evidence that was presented.
Somehow they still found 12
yeah.
for your third trial.
They're saying there's 12 people that are unreasonable.
Make it make sense.
So at the time, and I don't know if that's still the case, but at the time, this was only the fourth case to ever be overturned for insufficiency of evidence, for specifically for no reasonable juror could convict based on the evidence that was presented.
I'm rarely at a loss for words, Mario, but this is one of those times. But so let me just take a deep breath and then let's get to the good stuff.
So 2 days later, I am told that I'm going to be released by the guards. So I'm packing everything up. And I go to the front door. The warden is there. I actually asked the warden if I could speak to her about running her facility more efficiently. And she thought that was very odd. She said, you're free to walk out the door. And I said, yeah, I know. But I was brought up in a grocery store and we had a pretty large business. So in a very professional manner, said, I think you could address these issues and you guys would actually make more money too. And it boiled all the way down to phones. So there was only 4 phones available on the yard, but there's 250 people. I said, why don't you triple the amount of phones? Because they're making $10 a phone call at the time. So it would be to their benefit to have more phones. But also what happened is the gangs, one of the biggest reasons they had power is they would control the phone. So I explained to her, why don't you triple the amount of phones? You guys can make more money. You'd have less fights. And she acted like she had no idea. And then she was like, you're being released. See you later. So my family brings clothes in to me. And then I walk out the door. Kathleen, she raised my hand up as we were walking down the stairs because we had defeated the state after a long, rigorous war, 13 years after the disappearance.
You and Brian were close though, right? So what did his 13 siblings think of all this?
I had spoken to a few of them during the years, and it seems like they're conflicted. Some think that I'm responsible, some don't. Some of the siblings thought that I knew what happened and that I wasn't telling them or wasn't coming clean to the police department, when in reality, I would have been the first one that would have, because it would have absolved me from having anything to do with this. They were all really good people. I feel terrible that this happened to them. For me, I wish they would have directed their energy more at being upset with the state's attorney's office for just having such an inadequate investigation in the local police department.
The reasons for that righteous indignation ended up on full display during the depositions for Mario's civil litigation.
When we were deposing the lead investigator, he disclosed to us that he had never been to the police academy prior to this investigation.
Yeah, because I always start in those depths with, well, give us a little bit about your job history.
3 months before the investigation, he was working at Ace Hardware and he was let go for being an incompetent stockman, and then walked into the police department and was told that they were looking for somebody part-time. He had never been to the police academy prior to this investigation. He was pending. He was going to go. So a guy that was let go from the Ace Hardware because he couldn't figure out where to stock items correctly, 3 months in, is now in charge of a murder investigation.
He felt tremendous guilt because he really gave up everything in that deposition. It was like, you know, I never should have done that.
And even their attorneys were just in awe. And then we informed him that if you know somebody's innocent of a crime, you have what's called a duty to intervene. And his response was, I didn't know that I could do that. I didn't know that I could tell the state's attorney that you guys have the wrong guy. So honestly, the civil rights depositions made everything that happened over the years crystal clear, and you could see why it happened. And it boiled all the way down to, if somebody's not trained to be a police officer and has no experience and has no idea what they're doing, they should not be at a crime scene. I mean, he's at the crime scene touching everything without gloves on because he didn't know that you should put gloves on.
If only McHenry County managed to have the same standards as Ace Hardware. I mean, can you imagine? Not to mention how the prosecuting attorneys, Michael Combs and Patrick Keneally, had the same duty, right? They did, to intervene. But in a sick, sinister twist, they somehow still felt it was appropriate for them to high-five each other when you got convicted.
But karma works itself out, I think. I don't know if you guys have followed aftermath, but the prosecutor that was the lead on this case ended up being fired and is pretty much incapable of finding a meaningful employment. Interestingly, because it's a small town, multiple people have sent me. He can't control his liquor, so he falls off bar stools and talks about how powerful he is in that little town. His claim to fame was that he got a conviction with no body. He's willing to tell people this and acts like as if it's an achievement when really he should be ashamed of himself. And then the second prosecutor is now the state's attorney of the county, but has had a number of issues. I know he attacked his wife. The police were called and just really become an embarrassment to the state.
Meanwhile, since his release, Mario graduated from Loyola Law School and was admitted to the Illinois State Bar in 2019, all while settling his civil case.
So I actually settled with the state's attorney's office and with the police department separately. I'm one of very few people, if any, I've never actually met any other wrongfully convicted people that actually settled with the state's attorney's office because they have absolute immunity. And they still settled with me primarily because they were concerned about their image, the way that they were being portrayed in the media. And I think that they were concerned if this went any further, that their law licenses would be in jeopardy.
Mario, it's been a real joy for me to get to know you and to work with you on cases. And I'm just so happy that you have come through this and, you know, risen above it. So with that, we're going to go to closing arguments, where first of all, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining us and sharing your incredible story. And now I'm going to kick back in my chair, turn my microphone off, leave my headphones on, close my eyes, and just listen to anything else you have to say.
For as awful of a situation as it was that happened to me, the silver lining was, as I came out of this, winning my civil rights lawsuit, publicly embarrassing the state's attorney's office, and I am a successful attorney. In a weird way, this changed my life trajectory. It's almost like if you watch the movie Back to the Future, the moment that Brian Carrick disappeared changed my entire life. And now I'm sitting here as a criminal defense attorney working in post-conviction unit in Cook County, and I've had a huge effect on a lot of my clients' lives. I've had people that I've had life sentences vacated. It's alarming that this could easily happen again. There's just so many incompetent people still involved and still in positions of power in that very county. And that's why I try to talk to people about how important it is to actually pay attention to your local elections. The people that you elect to be judge, your state's attorney, are often more critical to you than electing the president, because those are the people that can indict you, or indict the wrong person, or choose to not charge people. It's a very, very important job. I can't stress that enough.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350+ live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.